Welcome back. I'm Mark Steiner. As I said at the top of the hour, you're listening here to The Mark Steiner Show and reminding you that The Mark Steiner Show is made possible by Johns Hopkins Medicine. For the 19th consecutive year, the Johns Hopkins Hospital has been ranked number one by U.S. News & World Report in their annual Best Hospital Survey. Find out more about the nation's top hospital at hopkinsmedicine.org. And this hour, we're going to talk about what it means to be not criminally responsible for your actions. Rick Vatz, who is a professor at Towson University, who has been a guest on my show many times over the last 16 years, is also editor of Current Psychology and associate psychology editor at USA Today magazine, wrote an op-ed in the Baltimore Sun. And in that op-ed, he took on the lack of a conviction to David Briggs, who brutally murdered Aisha Ring in November 2008, walked up to her in a liquor store, stabbed her in the neck, where she died. He was arrested, actually, the very next day in Pennsylvania because he was preaching in a homeless shelter naked and was taken to jail and then later arrested here in Baltimore for the crime of killing Aisha Riggs. But he was not sent to prison. He was sent to Clifton T. Perkins because he was deemed not responsible. Now, that not responsible goes back a long way. It goes back to a thing that we'll talk about, which was the McNaughton principle, the Daniel McNaughton case, who back in 1843 set off to kill the Prime Minister of England, but instead killed his secretary. And from that moment on, Western society has had this plea of not being criminally responsible or being not responsible for your actions. And Maryland is a state that has that. Four states don't. Most states in the union do. It's very rarely used.
It is true.
I read all the statistics just before we went on the air. And in all the times it's used, barely a quarter of the cases get adjudicated that way. Most do not. But it's still used, and should it be used, is the question. So Rick Vatz is here because he wrote the piece, and I want him to come on the air to be able to argue that. Timothy Scully is with us. Timothy Scully is Deputy Chief Attorney in the Mental Health Division of the Public Defender's Office. And Timothy Scully and Rick Vatz, good to have you both in the studio.
I didn't mean to disagree with you and interrupt you.
You may disagree with me anytime. It's not.
I did mean to disagree with you, but I didn't mean to interrupt you.
And I agreed with you. You're right.
And the number here is 410-319-8888. How do you feel about that? I mean, do you think that a defense of not being responsible for your actions, not criminally responsible for what you do, is a legitimate defense? Or do you not? Some people might argue that anybody kills anybody has to be have some kind of mental illness to start with. But we'll talk about all that and more. So what are your thoughts? 410-319-8888. Is that an acceptable defense? Many people have used it. You write to us here at steinershow@gmail.com. So, Rick, you started this off with the op-ed you wrote, and I immediately got in touch with you as soon as the op-ed was written and said, please come on the show and let's discuss what you've written.
Yeah. Aisha Ring. That's how she pronounced her first name.
Not Aisha. I said it's Aisha. Pardon me. I'm sorry.
That's right. Aisha Ring was murdered by David Briggs and found not criminally responsible. She Briggs was committed to Clifton T. Perkins Hospital in Jessup. He can be evaluated in a year, and he can petition for earlier evaluation to be released. The prosecutor, Ann Brobst, has assured me that at least for the first year in which he is evaluated, that she will ensure that he not be released. I wanted to find out about what psychiatrists had interviewed him, which is, by the way, public knowledge. And so I was told by Prosecutor Brobst to talk to psychiatrist Dr. Ann Hansen of Clifton Perkins, because she signed off on the finding by a team of psychiatrists. So I talked to her on the phone, and she said she could not reveal the names of the psychiatrists who examined David Briggs. And I said, but it's public information. She said, well, I'm sorry, but I am not permitted to do that. And she told me to call Sheila Davenport, the chief executive officer at Perkins. So I called Sheila Davenport, and I got her voicemail, and I left a message. And I got a return call about 3 or 4 hours later from the director of forensic services of the Department of Health and Mental Hygiene. And she told me that I could not get this information except by getting an okay from Briggs's attorney. So therefore, I was unable to find out that Annette Hansen and Larry Donner interviewed Briggs, and I was also unable to find out that Neil Blumberg, who was retained by the defense for pretrial assessment, that Dr. Hansen spoke with him regarding his findings. You may wonder how I found these things out, and I'm not going to tell you. But I will tell you that they are the principals of the people who interviewed Mr. Briggs, and they came up with this utterly bizarre finding, an arbitrary finding, that Mr. Briggs didn't know what he was doing at the time he did it and had no control over what he did, even though, insofar as not appreciating the criminality, he ran from the scene after he committed the crime. He got rid of his weapons. He got rid of his clothes. There is evidence that in interviews he indicated that he chose Asia Ring because she was the only white woman in the store. So there may have been a racial motive behind it. But all of this would not be known if I had not investigated this, and if it had not been for Asia Ring's father, Mike Ring, who parenthetically is a wonderful, wonderful human being. And I have heard, is a parenthetical as well, but I have heard from so many people over the last 8 months who knew Asia Ring, who said that she was just a singly wonderful, decent human being.
Okay, and by the way, just for the record, though, I didn't know the names of the psychiatrists who interviewed him, but the issue of his being black and her being white was raised in newspapers when it first happened. So it's not like that's a revelation. I mean, that was
right.
And we'll talk about what you just said. What part of it? I mean, I think saying it was racially motivated it could be a tad pejorative. I mean, we don't know, because that could also be one of the reasons he was mentally ill. So if in fact he was, but I'm just going to throw that out as a right. kind of way to what you just said.
I understand that the race in this is almost irrelevant to me.
Well, yeah, but you raised it. I didn't.
I'm not saying it's irrelevant to the case. I'm just saying it's irrelevant to me because I'm not discussing this because I think that this society has a racial problem that is particularly salient in my mind. My problem is this outrageous finding of not criminally responsible for an individual by psychiatrists and psychologists who don't want to be publicly responsible for what they found, who don't want to. And may I say one other thing? I have a statement from Mike Ring, the father of the woman who was killed. And this is just a couple sentences. I have neither heard from nor seen anyone associated with a mental health assessment. I was made aware of the finding by the state's attorney's office the day that office received word, and it was reiterated to me at the time that we had no recourse. They never made any effort to talk to him. In fact, he never even met with him.
Tim Scully.
There's not much I can say about this because I don't know about this case, and I haven't seen the evaluations. I haven't spoken to the gentleman. And what I do want to say is that it was a horrible crime. And I live in that area, and it particularly struck me the day it occurred. And that is, my heart goes out to her father, Mike. But when we're looking at this issue, I can discuss it in general and tell you what's going on with NCRs, et cetera. It used to be, just letting you know, not guilty by reason of insanity.
That's what it used to be.
That was the McNaughton thing. Right after the shooting of President Reagan, everybody changed their statutes, including us, and it became not criminally responsible. In order for that to occur, first there has to be a finding of guilt. Because if you're innocent, it doesn't matter whether you're responsible or not. Once there is a finding of guilt, you then address whether the person at the time was criminally responsible. And that is set out where, if you file that, number one, the defense can get their own evaluations. The state, they can hire their own expert, or very often, in fact, in most of the cases, the court medical, or, you know, there's a court eval, and the idea is, like the ones done at Perkins, that wasn't hired by us. That is DHMH, and they do their evaluations. I can't address, as you are saying, about this situation.
How about the secrecy? What do you think about that?
Well, I have to be honest that I have never heard that people can't find out who the experts are. That's something beyond my ken.
But it's public knowledge. It is legally public knowledge.
I can't address that because I'm not the one who, again, I've never heard of them not sharing that.
So you're saying you can't, Matt, you haven't heard of this kind of behavior on the part of the psychiatrist before.
Well, I'm also saying I don't know if this is on the part of psychiatrists. I just heard you say that people wouldn't give you the information. I just never heard that these specific doctors did anything. I don't know anything about that.
But you understand that they refused to talk or even to meet with the decedent's father.
Well, again, I cannot talk about this specific case because I don't know about it.
No.
And I don't know whether they refused, whether they were asked for.
You can talk about it conditionally. You can talk about it conditionally. That is, if – unless this is a misrepresentation. If what he's saying is true, do you think that's appropriate?
I don't know enough. The case is so specific that cannot be answered.
Let me ask you this question, Tim. What would make it appropriate? What would make it appropriate not to share that information? What would – if you're trying a case or if you're defending a case, what would make it appropriate for a prosecuting attorney not to reveal – that information to the family of the victim? What would be the arguments you could see in that?
I've never heard of this happening. Brand new to me. Within 10 years of doing this in mental health, and I don't see why prosecuting attorney didn't share.
There's a small imprecision. I'm not telling you that he was unable to find out who they were. I'm saying they never met with him, they never talked with him, they never said a word to him.
Who's the they?
I'm saying that the psychiatrist...
Oh, but it's not a psychiatrist's job to do that.
It's not a psychiatrist's job to talk to the decedent's father to say, here is this... Why not?
It's not. That's not the psychiatrist's
job.
But
when you say it's not their job, this is a man who has lost his daughter to a horrible crime.
That's the job of the prosecutor to reveal the information, to give it to the family or the opposing attorney.
But they said that the information is not available to discuss why this person was found to be not criminally responsible.
Who said?
I don't know what you mean. The psychiatrists are not publicizing.
If what I'm saying is, if the psychiatrist's report is part of a public testimony,
right,
which it is,
right,
then the prosecutor has access to it. The defense attorney has access to it. So either the defense attorney, or in this case a prosecutor, would be the one to give that report or a copy of the report.
That's not what they were told. They were told that this information is not available.
To whom? Who told them?
It's not the prosecutor. All right, I don't want to quote somebody that I don't know said this, but from what I've been led to understand, this information was sealed. And it has not been given to anybody except the prosecutor knows the result. You're saying they have an obligation. And just understand what you're saying. That they have an obligation to apprise the decedent's father.
That's not what he's saying. We're talking about that. No, you're saying that.
I'm saying that if there are any reports, they are given to the prosecution. They have them. Signed with all that information.
And they can share. There's nothing to prevent. You're telling me there's nothing to prevent this prosecutor from sharing all of this information with the decedent's father?
I have to be honest. I have not looked at the rules about sharing this psychiatric report. There is obvious it's going to be in public record. If it's sealed, it's sealed by the judge. So that's another issue.
It's Judge Bollinger.
But I'm just saying, I'm not going to be able to second guess anybody here because I just don't know what occurred. And also, in looking at the issue of not criminally responsible and talking about it, that's way off track. I mean,
what does it mean to be not criminally responsible?
It means at the time of the offense, I can quote the statute. It means at the time at the offense that because of a mental disorder or mental retardation, the defendant lacks substantial capacity to appreciate the criminality of that conduct or conform that conduct to the requirements of the law.
That's word for word in the article, by the way.
Pardon?
That's in my article.
Quoted word for word in his article.
Okay, so the question seems to me, I mean, beyond the emotions of this case, because every case that involves a victim – and a perpetrator, especially in a murder case, is filled with emotion. I mean, it's your family member, it's your child, it's your father, it's your mother, whoever it is, your brother, your sister. So that is becomes very emotional for anybody involved with the family, as with you.
Yeah, but this is special.
Well, it's no more special than any other case.
Of course it is, Mark.
Why?
Because this was done by a complete stranger to a woman who was standing in a convenience store line.
Okay, but no, what I'm saying is, I understand this. It's horrendous. But I don't find that more special than the murder of a cab driver who's driving on the street and someone goes to rob him.
No, but you can when a person takes risks in life and relative risks in everything he or she does. Standing in a convenience line, in a convenience store line, waiting to pay for something, is a particularly low-risk behavior. That makes it more poignant. Does that mean that the cab driver who's killed is something about which we're unconcerned? No. But it certainly adds to the poignancy of the situation.
Maybe. But the pain of a loss of somebody in a murder is a pain of loss of somebody in a murder.
But that doesn't, yes.
For the family. And the issue of whether somebody is not criminally responsible is the issue here. The issue is, should that defense be used? And how should that defense be used?
And how often it is used.
Let's talk about that.
And I was contacted yesterday evening, so I can only gather a little bit. And this bolsters my own personal experience in seeing raw numbers. It's not used that often. It just isn't.
I can tell you precisely how often it's used. It's successful.
Can I?
I thought I was filling in a point.
Well, I wasn't done yet.
Okay.
I do know, looking at numbers from 2005, and the numbers, as far as I know, are fairly consistent, there was a grand total of about 285,000 criminal cases in Maryland. Of those, and that's District and Circuit Court, NCR was filed in 552. That's how often it was filed. Out of that, 91 and they were all evaluated by the people, not all at Perkins, but by the court's medical people. 91 were opined by the department to be NCR. And of that, 79 were in fact found to be NCR.
Out of 552
that it was filed, and that's out of 285,000 cases. I'm rounding it off.
Okay. Now, let me make a couple points. Mm-hmm. Typically, the percentage is 0.25% of cases result in either an insanity plea in some venues or not criminally responsible. The absolute number in Maryland may be 91. I don't know. But is that a small number? Is that a large number? I don't care. It's irrelevant. It depends on what you think of the number 91. The fact of the matter is that is 91 people in which a psychiatric finding is utterly exculpatory and utterly irrelevant and utterly outrageous. Second point, the use of psychiatry exists throughout the criminal justice system. All kinds of sentences are mitigated when at sentencing hearings psychiatrists testify. Psychiatrists are irrelevantly and absurdly involved throughout the criminal justice system. The fact that 91 people get off by being found not criminally responsible doesn't impress me as a small number. Secondly, again, the use of psychiatry throughout the criminal justice system is just an outrage, and it exists because people are mystified by psychiatry. They look at psychiatry and think they know something that they don't know, but they don't. All they know is that when they talk to – and by the way, last point I'll make is if you listen to people in the criminal justice system who are skeptical about psychiatrists in that system, they'll say that the system is gamed over and over. That is, people in the system learn how to use psychiatrists in order to mitigate their sentences.
That's a subjective analysis, though.
That's very subjective.
What do you mean subjective? That they try to do it or that they succeed?
Well, the issue I'm seeing here
this is an absurd distinction.
Basically, what I'm hearing you say is that you just don't think that not criminally responsible should be an option, and that pretty much psychiatry and psychology is not science and shouldn't be looked at anyway.
Which
is
surely not science.
But see, I there's not much I can say to that. I believe it is a science. I believe that there is something they can say. And it's, I can't just dispute or throw out arbitrarily an entire science.
Let me tell you why it's not a science.
Well, wait. Okay. 410-319-8888. One, an uncommonly used defense is a defense saying one is not criminally responsible for their actions. And the psychiatrist testify in court after studying a defendant to determine whether or not this person can stand trial because they knew what their actions were, that their actions were had criminal intent. Now, do you think that's a defense that we could and should use? What is your experience in life? What do you think about this? At 410-319-8888. Write to us here at steinershow@gmail.com. Or write to us, as I say, write to us at steinershow@gmail.com. Or log on to Facebook, and I'll check the Facebook and see if you've written in there. Or just call us here at 410-319-8888. Get to those calls as they're coming in. And part of the argument we're having here was Rick Fatch wrote the editorial op-ed in The Sun as a result of a case that he was very familiar with when David Briggs was found not to be competent to stand trial and was remanded to Clifton T. Perkins, where he could either spend the rest of his life or he could spend 5 years, 10 years, or a year, depending on what happens. So it is, I would say, very difficult to get out once you've been incarcerated in institutions like Clifton T. Perkins. The number of people who come out of there
once
is
it's
very,
publicized,
very
it's
small.
Particularly difficult.
The question is, and Tim Scully's on the other side, who is Deputy Chief Attorney in the Mental Health Division of the Public Defender's Office. And so, but a part of the argument going on here at the moment that you've just raised, Rick Fatz, which is a different argument than we really were going to talk about since you raised it, and there's not a psychiatrist here.
See, that's what we would need.
Then we can have a better debate.
There's never a psychiatrist there when you talk about forensic psychiatry because they're all embarrassed by it.
No, because I think I could have found somebody if I knew we were going to do that. I could have found somebody without a problem at all.
I disagree.
I know I could.
Well, no,
I've done it before.
I don't mean literally you couldn't have found somebody.
They'd be here to debate you.
Could I make one point on that?
You're going to force me to debate you, which I don't want to do.
For 30 years, I've been critical of psychiatry, okay, in writing, okay? And I've had all kinds of people, psychiatrists, psychologists, and neurologists disagree with me all the time. I mean, we have great discussions because I like a lot of them. Do you know that every time I have a disagreement with a psychiatrist, psychologist, or neurologist, and I bring up forensic psychiatry, they say, I'm not here to defend forensic psychiatry. Forensic psychiatry, even among psychiatrists, psychologists, neurologists, is the embarrassment of the field.
I'm not a psychiatrist, and again, I am not qualified to even address that. I think you need a psychiatrist here.
Fine.
Because you're just
let
doing
him call
broad
in.
Strokes.
Tell a psychiatrist to call in.
Can I tell you one thing that we were talking about, however, and trying to get back to a case in point as opposed to whether psychiatry exists, is what happens to a person when they are found NCR. When they are found not criminally responsible, they are then brought to a psychiatric facility, and then there's a hearing within 50 days as to whether there is something called conditional release, which is the equivalent of mental health probation, just really making it simple. A person can be released on that. It's for a maximum of 5 years, but it's renewable ad infinitum. What happens is you have that hearing, very few people are released at the 50-day hearing at all. And then you don't have automatically a hearing every year. You can ask for one. The burden of proof is on the defense to show that it is safe to do that. And additionally, an ALJ, an administrative law judge, hears the case. It then goes before that decision, or it can go before the sentencing judge. The state's attorney is involved at all steps. It is not easy for people to be released. It is not where they get off on this defense at all.
You're talking about, Tim, you're talking about subjectivity. When you say it's not easy to be released, is that a subjective judgment you're making?
I'm talking about just numbers. They don't get released.
410-319-8888. And Julie, you're on the air.
Okay.
Hello.
Hi, Julie.
I'm just wanting to say I was driving in my car and had to pull over to respond to this. I want to respond and say two things. One, as a child, I guess I must have been 12 years old, a woman who attended my church was murdered by her husband. Now, I'm 50 years old now, so that was quite a few years ago. However, that has remained with me. I don't know if NCR was even an option then, but I know that he was, for whatever reason, he was released. The insanity piece was in place according to how he was sentenced. And maybe about 4 years later, I saw him in the public with a new wife, and I just completely freaked out. So in terms of this defense, as far as I'm concerned, it's completely immaterial whether the person has been studied and found to be in a state where they would not be aware of the wrongness of their actions or whatever the case may be, however you want to frame it. As far as I see it, if the evidence is there to convict you of having committed that crime, whether you were aware of it being a crime or whatever you want to say, I think if you did the crime, you need to be held responsible for it.
Julie, you raised an important point. Let me take a twist on what you said to throw this out to our guests here, and let's see what other listeners think at 410-319-8888. That maybe the argument we're having here, in some levels, isn't the real argument. Maybe the argument is that if someone commits a crime and they, on the bare facts, are guilty of that crime, maybe the problem is once they're convicted and where they go, what happens to them? In other words, in our criminal justice system, the mental health facilities inside of our criminal justice system are lacking or non-existent.
Yes.
We don't do anything to work with people who have been convicted of crimes, committed crimes, to work through what they've done, or to help the victims, or to help these people kind of recover from their criminal activity. I mean, that may be the issue. And maybe we get lost in this argument about not criminal responsible is really the wrong argument that this society should be having. Just going to posit that for a minute.
Well, I agree. One of the things we need, and you know, fundings are being cut for programs, not only in any kind of incarceration situation, but also on the street. And you're going to be seeing this, not this, I hope, but people who are mentally ill being involved with the criminal justice system more often. And obviously, I think it's better all around so that things don't occur, that be addressed. That's where we are.
Rick, let me just ask you to hold your response.
Sure.
I just want to throw this out and can maybe change the tenor of the argument for a minute, see if we can. Maybe it won't. 410-319-8888. We'll be right back as we talk about the question of whether or not someone can be judged as criminally not responsible for the actions they've committed when they've been found guilty of a crime that they have committed, and was brought to light because of Richard Vatz's article on the David Briggs case that was just adjudicated. 410-319-8888 is the number here. The Mark Steiner Show is brought to you by MeQ, Baltimore's credit union, offering a full range of financial services. MeQ was formed in 1936 to help people during the Great Depression. And over 70 years later, they're still here to help people during difficult times. For more information, you can go to mecu.com. We'll be right back. Welcome back. I'm Mark Steiner. We are arguing this hour and discussing on the air whether or not one should be allowed to be criminally not responsible for their actions after they've been convicted of a crime. This came up in this conversation today on the air because Rick Vatz wrote an editorial, of which I would say, and he would say as well, that he was personally involved because he knows the people intimately that were involved in this case. But it was when David Briggs...
I wouldn't say intimately.
Okay, I'm sorry. But David Briggs, who stabbed to death Asia Ring while she was waiting in line in Catonsville in a liquor store. And he walked in and stabbed her in the neck and was subsequently caught, and he's now being remanded to Clifton T. Perkins Institution, which is a mental institution inside the criminal justice system where people are...
So he can get help.
We would hope he does. 410-319-8888. God. Write to us here at steinershow@gmail.com. You were going to respond to my last comment, and then we're going to go right back to the phone.
Yeah, I don't want to scandalize your audience, but... I'm not overly concerned about the, quote, mental health of people who commit terrible crimes.
Well, then they'll come out and commit them again.
Well, I have news for you. They'll come out and commit them again regardless. If such work had any effect on recidivism, you'd hear them blasting those statistics out on a daily basis.
Well, the recidivism rate that I could find for people who were found not criminally responsible, and who were subsequently released on conditional release, and either it ended or they were continued on it, was significantly less, and I'm not going to get how much because I'm not sure, than 5%, which is really less than people coming out of jail. Well, so obviously it's doing something, and you're giving people help. Sometimes it's just needing medication.
First of all, the recidivism rate for murder is generally less than recidivism rate for other crimes because most people, when they commit a murder, they've committed their murder. Most people are not, like robbers have a tremendously high recidivism rate because when they get out, they're still robbers. They still want to kill. Murder is a much more personal sort of thing. But the rate of people who commit violent acts when they, for example, given furloughs is about 23% over the next couple of years.
When you say furloughs, is that what do you – I'm not sure what you mean.
This is in states where people who have been convicted of crimes are allowed out for various amounts of time, and the rate of crime commission after they are let out is about 20 to 23%.
And if they were found NCR and got services, it's less than 5%.
Well, I you know –
410-319-8888. James in Park Heights, you're on the air.
Well, this is sort of a statement and a question.
Sure.
And I'm going to make it quick. Some years ago, and I'm from Baltimore, there was a gentleman in City Hall and committed murder because he couldn't get anyone to listen to him. He couldn't find a job, and he had a family.
Right.
And he was eventually released, maybe 30-something years later. He was released. But my question and comment is this. If a person is criminally insane and commits a crime and is committed, shouldn't that person remain committed? Because the same thing might happen again. Now, the gentleman who just committed the murder, Miss Azering, I don't believe he was criminally insane because he hid the weapon. Even the charade that he, when he was arrested, was naked or whatever.
Right.
I don't believe he was criminally insane. I really, really don't. I know you guys are talking about statistics.
I don't either.
But it's a real problem. They need to put money into it. These people are being treated as far as what I know. But it was horrible what the gentleman did to Azering. And I don't believe he's criminally insane. I really do not. He had some good lawyers.
Now, Tim, until this moment, you've said you don't have enough information.
Well, James, did you finish your thought?
Yeah, I'm finished.
Okay.
Tim, before this moment, you said you have enough information, and now you say you've come to the conclusion that he should be found not criminally responsible?
Well, all I know is that there were evaluations done, and I respect psychiatrists and that field, and that there was a judge who looked at it and found that to have occurred. Right now, I probably should then backstep just a little bit. I really have never seen the evals. I don't know anything about this case.
So you don't know then?
So I will admit I don't know. But I do know that there has been this filtering device of the system that is very difficult to overcome. And that does mean something.
Let me tell you, by the way, that the judge, Thomas Bollinger, is the judge who, when Paul Shrum was watching a movie at Lowe's Valley Center 9 in 2006 and was shot by a fellow named Jabbar, this judge ordered into a state psychiatric facility, even though every possible bit of evidence was that Jabbar had planned for months to go kill somebody, and that after he killed him, he put down his weapon and he said he was waiting for the police.
410-319-8888. Ferdinand in North Baltimore, you're on the air.
Can you hear me?
Yes, we can.
Okay. It seems to me that there's a lot of different rulers that you can use to measure responsibility, criminal responsibility. And if you go outside of our society and you look at, for example, at one end of the spectrum, child soldiers in Liberia or Cambodia, these children are performing horrible, horrible acts. And they are totally inured to any sense of responsibility. Do we consider them not criminally responsible? You see, I mean, there's a lot of different questions that have to be asked. But it seems to me that no matter what, you've still got to get them out of the way.
Right.
You can't put them in any kind of circumstances where circumstances could dictate to them to do it again.
Right. Is the exactly caller is the purpose of is the purpose of punishment partially incapacitation? I mean, why do we always put rehabilitation above incapacitation?
I think you should put rehabilitation out there, but the question is, how do you measure the rehabilitation and how
do you want to put it above incapacitation? You just said
I said that you've got to, there's got to be both. But the question is, and let me finish, how do you measure rehabilitation and how do you test it? And the only way to test it is to throw them back in the water and see if they swim. And I have a lot of problem with that.
Well, when I'm looking at this,
Tim Scully,
you're talking about the purposes of punishment. I teach the sociology of law at Goucher. I've done that for the last 17 years. There are four purposes. Retribution, incapacitation, which means they're locked up and they won't do it again. Deterrence, both general and specific. And punishing, really not, but there's rehabilitation as part of this. What we're looking at is, as a society, when we were founded from England, we had the idea that somebody who is insane is not going to be held criminally responsible. Back then, not guilty by reason of insanity. We have never, here in Maryland, broken that. We now have not criminally responsible, and we have a system that I think I've shown is not used that often. The deterrence obviously works because the recidivism rate is significantly lower, and I know you're going to say that any reoccurrence is too much, and I can understand as a citizen you saying that, but what we have is a system that actually does work. These people are kept in hospitals. It's not a walk in the park. They can be medicated. If they are released, there's incredible oversight.
So if you're
mainly with the callers and with you is just people saying, I don't like that it exists at all. And as an attorney, I deal with what I have, and this is what we have and what we've always had.
You're saying that it's worth it to you that 91 – let's use your figures. You're saying it's worth it to you that 91 people were killed.
I didn't – where's that number?
That's the number that you gave before.
Of people who
– No, I said 91 people were opined by the department as NCR.
Right.
79
victims. I'm talking about the victims.
That's not all murders.
But it doesn't matter.
Well, you said killed. I'm sorry.
No, okay. I was imprecise. I'm sorry. But when you say it works, what constitutes working? That's a number that's acceptable to you. How about 200? How about 500? What number is not acceptable to you? Tell me the number, Tim. Tell me the number at which you would say that's not acceptable.
Let me ask them a question rather than a position. But what is... What's a response to saying? Are you talking about numbers? Or are you talking about something else? When you say that not being held criminally responsible is acceptable?
Well, I'm saying, first of all, when we're looking at whether it's acceptable or not, just really comes to your view of society. And as our society it has developed, we've always said that insanity is a defense, no matter how it's incorporated or utilized. And we acknowledge that as a society. Obviously, some people disagree. And that's subject for, I believe, another debate with maybe people who know psychiatrists, et cetera, on that level. But when we're looking at the numbers here and, you know, having read your article, it appears that people are trying to say it's used all the time. These people are getting out easily, that it's a joke. And when we're looking at the numbers, you know, almost 300,000 crimes, it's only asked for 550. People opine. And asked for doesn't mean you get it. 91 people are opined. 79 people are found NCR. And that means they go into hospitals. It's not that they're going out and committing crime. And when we're looking at, you were the person who said, if someone's in jail and they're released, 23% of them go on to commit other crimes. And it's under 5%. The numbers I looked at, it was 3% or less. Have any kind of recidivism. We're not talking about murders, and any one murder is too much. But when I'm looking at these,
but you don't believe that.
Let me ask you this question, Mike.
Yes, I do.
So let's say that whatever the number is.
Yeah.
You talking about numbers, but whatever the number is.
Yeah. A number of. I'm sorry.
People who are found to be not criminally responsible.
Yeah. Okay.
If those people are remanded to a psychiatric prison, which is what Clifton T. Perkins is.
Yeah.
It's got barbed wire, its walls, you're inside of a jail, you're not walking out. It's not like you're Shepherd Pratt and can walk out the door.
Yeah, but it's not pleasant. You're saying it's much pleasanter than a prison.
I'm not so sure about that. My business there, I would not say that. It's not a very pleasant place to be to me. It's a prison. It just happens to be full of people who...
And they can medicate you, and which they can't in jail, and a whole
lot of things they can't do in jail. Yeah, it's a much worse place in some ways.
Okay,
But if they're incarcerated, but in a mental institution as opposed to a prison, they're still incarcerated.
Yeah, for how long?
Usually for...
A long time.
A long, long time.
Yeah, often for a long time, but there are all kinds of cases of people getting out.
But are there all kinds of cases of people who are convicted of crimes going for... parole boards and getting out as well.
Yeah, and that's terrible too.
And when you go to jail, you have a set sentence and you are released.
Say it again. I'm sorry.
If you are incarcerated in jail, you usually have a set sentence. And after that, it's done. Here, if you are found not criminally responsible,
but
depending
this,
on how you do, it could last. I've seen people be on it for 18
years. You cannot be serious that you're making that argument with respect to murder. I mean, you're given a set sentence. Yeah, if you're in a state that has half a brain, you are either executed for first degree murder, or you're in without parole.
That's a different debate, and that's not what our system is here.
But you're putting in this debate the problem that in Maryland you may be able to get a lighter sentence, so therefore it's okay to have this completely bogus psychiatric defense.
Well, see, I think these people are really sick. I really do.
Why do you think that?
Because I've dealt with the cases I've dealt with. I know that people are really sick. I'm convinced of that.
Because they don't murder in a way that you would murder if you murdered somebody?
Oh, that has nothing to do with it.
Well, then why do you
rule.
Think they're sick?
Because they've been found sick by psychiatrists, because I've met them and they are obviously either schizophrenic or... There's so much. Yeah, I mean, mental illness doesn't exist?
I don't think that most of what is called mental illness is illness, and if it were, it would be treated by neurologists, not psychiatrists.
Well, there's an ongoing debate, you know, the Hopkins, Shepard Pratt thing, medical model or therapeutic model, another discussion, and I'm not qualified to do that.
Let me
open the forums and let our listeners come back to this conversation with Rick Vatz and Tim Scully, 410-319-8888. As we look at the question of can someone be not criminally responsible for their actions? And Gary in Baltimore, you're on the air.
Hello.
Hi, Gary. You're on the air.
Hey, how you doing?
Well.
Okay. I kind of have like a question and a statement at the same time. You guys kind of touched on it a little bit. But my question is basically like, what's the logic behind the whole jail system and you know, the whole psychiatric ward kind of thing? Like, there's all these different levels. It's maximum security and low security, and then you have like your federal prisons, and then you have like it's all of these different things. But I feel like if you're a criminal, something is wrong with you, period. If you're out here committing crimes, period, something is wrong with you, period. Like, why not just revamp the whole jail system and have everybody get help? Like, I don't understand. Like, I think it's flawed because it has a judge. Like, if there's a crime, there should be a set sentence for that crime, and that's it. You know, why do different people get different, you know, sentences for the same crime? It doesn't make any sense, and I think it's because it has a judge there. You know, like, if the person is found guilty, then the person is found guilty, and he should be able to do the same amount of time as everybody else and get the same help as everybody else, because something is wrong with you because you committed that crime in the first place, in my opinion.
All right, Tim Scully?
That's an entirely different discussion. I'm talking about people here who we know are mentally ill. If you're talking about revamping the entire criminal justice system, again, I'm working with the system we have. And that's just, you know, people are sentenced differently. I really don't know how to respond to that because that's
– Well, let me ask you a question. Let me ask a question on this question. This fellow who killed yesterday, the day before, several women at the exercise location – You think he's mentally ill?
I have no clue.
Well, I have a clue. I think he had a purpose for killing him, and he killed him. And if he hadn't killed himself, I would hope that he would have been executed by the state. But you'd probably want to rehabilitate him, right?
I don't know. I don't know anything about him. You're making assumptions that...
Well, take it as a hypothetical. Take it as a hypothetical. Can you imagine that anybody would choose to kill women because he doesn't like women? Would you find that mentally ill, or would you find that a person who merely has to be incapacitated so he doesn't kill again?
And I'm not
punish.
Trying to duck it. I can't tell. You're making – it's. There's so what, much left open. I don't know if he's mentally ill.
This is what frustrates people because
– I have to illness, look at the guy.
The mental illness postulation in this situation is completely mythical. This
in
guy –
In which situation?
In the situation of a guy killing women randomly because he's had a bad history.
He could be mentally ill and still have to be incapacitated.
A lot of people are mentally ill and are not found not criminally responsible.
Let's call him.
410-319-8888. Tom in Washington, you're on the air.
Hi, thank you.
Thank you for calling.
All right, I want to get to someone that's saying that sick. What diagnoses a person as sick? Now, what do you guys think about this? How about papal bulls of 1452 and 1493, where the Pope slaughtered Native Americans? I mean, what category do you put that in? And also the transatlantic slave trade, when you cut the woman's womb open and stomped the baby. You know, what do you think about the people who did that, and what category do you put that in? I'm talking about 400, 600 years of this on so-called black people. What category is that in, and are they sick? Thank you.
They are very sick.
No, they're not sick at all. Nobody. When people commit crimes, they commit them for a purpose. Can you find me a crime in the country in which one cannot discern a purpose? Maybe you can find one. But I guarantee you can't find many. When people commit a crime, they have a purpose. It may not be your purpose. It may not be something you identify with. But this whole notion that a person who commits an atrocity, and the more of an atrocity he commits, the more likely he is to be found mentally ill, is just mythical, and the society suffers for it.
Now, that's one place where we can almost kind of arrive at some agreement.
Then I'll change my opinion.
Okay. That's why I wanted to give you some warning. Obviously, there might be times when the facts of a case might indicate that something's going on. But I would never look at a case just on the facts, no matter how horrific, and say, that person must be mentally ill. That's not how I look at it. When I'm looking at a person, I look at that person. And there are things that you look at. You know, do they have a chemical imbalance? Are they hallucinating? Are they delusional? Which has, I think we can agree, it's just not the horrible aspects of a crime that make me say that this person is ill, which is why I couldn't say whether that gentleman who did the things to the women is mentally ill, because I don't know, and I wasn't trying to duck it. I'm not going to be able, standing here saying, that's so horrific, he must be insane. I'm not saying that, and I never would.
Could I bring up one small mythological point you make?
Sure.
I know you argue all these ingenuously, okay? But when you say somebody has a chemical imbalance, do you know that there is no such thing as diagnosing a person as mentally ill because they have a chemical imbalance? In other words, what happens is that they will do chemical analyses of people that they've already ascertained may be mentally ill. If you had to do a double-blind test, if you had to do a test in which you simply had the chemical makeup of individuals, you wouldn't be able to say who was mentally ill and who was not mentally ill.
I would need a psychiatrist to tell me that.
Well, ask a psychiatrist. They won't call because they wouldn't call because they'll look absurd.
Well, I'm not saying that you're going to look at blood work and then say, oh, this is what that is. You're going to look at the entire person. Yeah. That's why when I can't answer a question, I need to know a lot more than just being that simplistic.
410-319-8888. Stephen in Aberdeen, you're on the air.
I have a comment. I'm kind of in between listening to the debate because I believe there's mental illness as far as like schizophrenia and things like that. But I still think they are responsible for the actions, because a lot of times in the cases that the person had to go over, you know, it didn't just happen spur of the moment. You know, they had to do something. They had to get a gun and shoot them, or, you know, there's some of the heinous things that happen. You know, I don't think you can just do that out of spur of the moment. And I think that they should be held criminally responsible for the things they've done. I say get them help, you know, for maybe what might be going on with them. But still, as far as the crime is concerned, I still think they're responsible. Thank you.
Thank you so much.
Again,
Tim Scully.
I think the one thing I found when I first took this job 10 years ago, I've been a public defender for 28 years doing juvenile and adult work, and I came into mental health.
Committed civil servant.
Oh, always. Mm-hmm. Came here with Vista. That's what I believe in. But when people sometimes think that in order to be mentally ill, you have to do something on the spur of the moment, that you have to be not intelligent, and that I had my eyes opened. It's radically different. You know, mental illness is insidious. It controls people. I disagree with you. I think it really does exist. I have seen it. And it's easy to just make these little things saying, well, if you could plan it ahead of time, obviously, that means you're not mentally ill, and no, you can have fixed delusions. There's so many things that are involved.
Yeah, you have to find the right psychiatrist. Look, Tim,
that's not true.
Neurologists will tell you that there's such a thing as brain disease. Nobody could deny that. The brain is an organ, but the mind is not an organ. You can't have diseased thinking. You can have a diseased brain, but you can't have diseased thinking.
But you have a diseased brain that's not capable of thinking properly.
But the reason
what's
you
the
say
difference?
But the difference is that when people don't think properly, what the psychiatrist is saying is that he wouldn't have done what they did. But people have purposes. They may not align with your purposes. When John Wilkes Booth, right, tried to in fact assassinate a president, right? Was he mentally ill?
I have no clue.
I do. He wasn't. He was an assassin who had a political purpose.
Maybe that's
purpose.
The difference. That what Tim Scully is saying, he has no clue because he hasn't seen the specific case. You're saying, maybe in a more visceral, subjective way, yes, they are, because that's what I feel.
Mm-hmm.
I wouldn't say mine's objective and Tim's is not. I would say both of them. No, because if you say that anybody can be mentally ill, then it's just simply a question of which psychiatrist you get who will find you to say, yeah, he's mentally ill. No, he's not mentally ill.
That's not true.
Of course it's true.
No, it isn't. I will get psychiatrists on cases all the time that come back and say no.
Well, I don't deny that.
And
that's where it ends.
It
depends what psychiatrist you get. That's perfectly consistent with what I just said.
Well, there's a difference. Are you saying it's what psychiatrist you get? Or are you saying it's the analysis a psychiatrist will give?
They'll look at this case and say it occurs or it isn't. And once the same psychiatrist can say it is. And I mean, again, I use people who I believe would be giving an evaluation, not an opinion. And I respect and use people who I know go against us on purpose because I want to make sure it's a good eval.
No appreciation.
See, but you don't think that an evaluation is valid, and I do.
Well, yeah, because you presumptively think it's valid. Of course it's valid when you decide that if a psychiatrist – you're saying if a psychiatrist makes an evaluation, it is ipso facto valid. And I'm saying to you
– Well, what I think I'm hearing as a question, Tim, you're saying that you use psychiatrists in cases that you work on as a public defender.
Yes.
And those psychiatrists in most instances are saying that the person should stand trial.
Not most. And again, I use psychiatrists who go both – when I give I authorize experts with my supervisor. We use experts who we don't know are going to just give us what we want. We get experts who we believe will do a valid job, and then they will tell us. When I am making an NCR plea, I'm not going to an expert and saying, prove their NCR. I'm going, you tell me.
Let me just.
And then that's where we go. What I'm hearing Richard say is that that's not valid.
Right.
And I'm also saying that from my own experience in the last 10 years now, which opened my eyes, it's validating everything I'm saying, my own reaction in meeting people.
Let me ask you this.
Yes.
Do you ever think about the effect on the relatives of the deceased in a murder case?
Every day, all the time.
Well, I think if you thought about them a little bit more, you would understand how horrible it is to have a guy like this, David Briggs, found not criminally responsible, have nobody interested in communicating to any principal in the case as to why they found that. I mean, it is as obscene as anything I have ever heard or experienced.
My heart goes out to the family, and we do know that, and I think of that all the time.
Gentlemen, I think this hour has run its course. I want to thank Richard Batts for once again joining us on the air.
Thank you.
Pleasure to have you here,
as always. And so you're just don't misunderstand. I think Tim's a good guy.
And Tim Scully, I want to appreciate you coming in, and it's a pleasure to meet you, and I hope you will come back again.
Invite me.
It's been good to have you here. The Mark Steiner Show is made possible by Urbanite, Baltimore's free magazine of ideas and innovation. August is Urbanite's annual stories issue featuring fiction, poetry, memoir, and plays from the region's emerging writers. Plus, a sneak preview of the upcoming art season, a look at changes in troubled Sandtown, and tall tales from readers. Urbanite is available at over 700 locations. Please visit www.urbaniteBaltimore.com for a list of our drop locations. The Mark Steiner Show is a production of the Center for Emerging Media. Our producers are Jessica Phillips and Justin Levy. We're engineered today by Brian Boone. Our interns are Judith Floyd, Brian Boone, Devin Finley, and Brad Kolodner. Our theme music is by Walt Matthews of Clean Cuts. To hear this show again, podcasting of our past shows, hear additional interviews, visit us on the web at steinershow.org. And for Public Radio, WEAA 88.9 FM, the voice of the community. I'm Mark Steiner. Take care.